Hi there, and welcome to this week's episode of Over and Under, where we take one film that we think is overrated and compare it with one film that's underappreciated. My name's Kareem Mohsin, and I'm going to be joined today by Mike and Ege.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
To kick us off, we're going to be looking at our overrated film for the week, which is Lost in Translation, which is directed by Sofia Coppola and came out in 2003. Mike's going to be leading us off with this film. Mike, take it away.
Yeah, well, I chose this film based on Ege's choice, which I guess we'll talk about later. But I don't really know why. I just, when I first saw it, I liked it enough, like most people, but I haven't seen it since. And I felt like it still has a fairly high amount of regard for being just like an okay movie. And upon watching it again, I feel like it's not even that good. It's not even an okay movie. Like, it's kind of racist and terrible. I don't know. That's the only thing I really want to say about it. I guess we can just take it from there.
Yeah, the racist thing is interesting because that's what I was thinking when I was watching it today, is that it's just the whole point you get out of it. It looks like it's just Japanese people are weird and kooky and they play weird video games and stuff and, you know, everything is just out of place, and it did have this kind of feeling. But I think it's an okay film. It just feels like, to me, it feels too much like a travelogue or something, like just Sofia Coppola's experiences in Japan just transferred into this film without much of a story. And it has an interesting opening, and then it kind of drags on.
Yeah, I think that racist piece did come up for me a little bit when I was watching it today. I was wondering, am I missing something? Is this film just offensive to Japanese people? But, you know, I have had the experience of my friends when I was younger. I had a couple of friends who were DJs, and they would go out to Japan, and I was like, wow, that sounds amazing. And they would be like, yeah, but it's weird. Like, I spent most of the time in the hotel room because it was such a culture shock. And because of the difference, the culture wasn't as accessible as they had imagined. And I've spoken to people where that's not the case. But I do think that, you know, that the film was kind of trying to get that point across, is that there is really like this big chasm between like the culture of Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson, and then the culture that they end up finding themselves in. And they're kind of in these like, this limbo, which is the hotel, which kind of is a blend of both worlds, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if you guys know much about the backstory of the film, but it's basically the Scarlett Johansson character is supposed to be Sofia Coppola when she was visiting Japan with her then husband, Spike Jonze.
Mm.
And actually, the Anna Faris character, the blonde movie star, mm-hmm. is supposed to be Cameron Diaz. And you can kind of tell how much Sofia Coppola liked Cameron Diaz, because that character is like the biggest, like, insane, like,
bimbo, yeah.
Typical blonde bimbo caricature that you could see. And it's around the time, the reason, of course, why Cameron Diaz and Spike Jonze know each other, they bump into each other, is because they did Being John Malkovich.
Yeah.
And apparently Cameron Diaz was in Japan promoting Charlie's Angels. And that's why in the movie you see Anna Faris doing like, oh, I'm doing this kick-ass action movie, so I'm promoting it and stuff like that. Yeah.
I thought something about her character, it was like they needed to make her so extreme and kind of dumb to make Bill Murray's character and Scarlett Johansson's character not seem like they were so dumb, you know, because if you just had them in there and there wasn't such an extreme example, they would look like these closed-minded idiots. But since you have this other person who is like, oh, I'm into yoga and all this stuff, you know, I don't know, they're trying to negate how stupid those characters are.
It's true, almost like, I see what you mean, almost like showing someone who's so much more shallow and stupid than the main characters, they end up looking okay. Yeah. That's kind of like a crime movie trope. Like if you, it's like a film noir or a crime movie, like Goodfellas. If you want to have like a criminal that's a main character, and if you want the audience to sympathize with them, you put in a like kind of a side character that's like way more evil and worse. than the main character, so that he ends up looking sympathetic, even though he's a criminal.
And the way they try to make them seem like they're intelligent people is, like Bill Murray says, like, well, I'm getting paid $2 million to endorse a whiskey when I could be doing a play somewhere. And then they mention that Scarlett Johansson went to Yale. It's like, that makes them smart, I guess.
Yeah, that's really about it. I mean, the characters otherwise, other than the exposition about their past, they really don't have that much depth. And that's kind of what the whole movie kind of feels like, as if Sofia Coppola just went into, had this trip to Japan and thought, oh, that was a weird trip. Why don't I just make a movie out of it? And most of it seems like characters just walking around and seeing these real life odd things in Japan, like the arcade or the Buddhist temple, or, you know, these very like unique things. And it just looks like, it just has this like travelogue, like Travel Channel feel to me, but that's just made by someone who's like an art house filmmaker.
I don't know, man. I actually really like this film, and I don't think that the characters are that two-dimensional. I think Bill Murray is just an incredible performance. It's really understated, but I couldn't help but keep watching him. I was mesmerized by his performance. He really, you know, he wasn't doing anything that was over or over the top, but I thought that he was really engaging. Mm-hmm. And I just like that character. It wasn't like he was depressed, but he was at a point where he was a little bit lost in his life. Mm-hmm. It was almost like he was lost in translation. But and then he meets the character Scarlett Johansson, and I like the balance, or the kind of line she walks between, the director, I mean, walks between, like, having these two, you expect them to come together at some point and have some kind of an affair, and it's not really about that. And the times that they spend together, it is like a love story, but it's like love in a more pure sense. Like, these two people find each other and support each other, and both of them are at a time of kind of immense confusion and disorientation, and then they find each other and they kind of support each other through that weird time. And they have fun, and I like the landscapes, the various landscapes that the director takes the viewers through. I think that, you know, I'm not used to those types of worlds, and I did find myself wanting, like, the story to go in a certain direction, or perhaps there to be more of a kind of, you know, narrative arc. But it was kind of interesting. It's just nothing happened, and I was pretty engaged the whole way through.
Yeah, I mean, it's engaging in I think mostly because of Bill Murray's casting. Mm-hmm. I think the casting of this film is its saving grace and downfall at the same time, because I don't think Scarlett Johansson is really good in this.
Really?
I think she's just... I know that she's supposed to portray this kind of ennui and kind of this boredom and being kind of stuck in a place where you don't really know what you're going to do with your life. But I think she just comes off as really kind of dull.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I agree. Like, I would just like to see some characters to have a little more intellectual curiosity. Like, they go out one night and they go to, you know, those clubs and karaoke and all that. And she goes to one Buddhist temple, but they never actually engage with, like, an actual human being over there, you know, in like a conversation that's not like a pot-fueled one or something.
Yeah, that's true. I think that the best thing about it is what you mentioned, Karima, for me, is that the relationship doesn't really take a romantic turn. It doesn't turn into this complicated kind of affair. I mean, there is, like you said, there is love between these two characters, but it doesn't turn into this, like, weird sexual thing, which, if this was a Woody Allen movie, you bet your ass that would have happened immediately. You have, like, a middle-aged man and a 17-year-old hot, sexy girl, you know? That's definitely going to happen.
But they're not related.
Yeah, that's true.
Don't you think, like, it's just weird that their love just comes out of their shared xenophobia?
Yeah, kind of. I don't know
that that's the case, though. I just think that they find this kind of connection between the two of them, and it's
that they're both white people in an elevator.
Yeah, that's true. That did stick out to me a little bit.
Yeah, maybe that's true. I don't know. I didn't find it as... It is really kind of offensive from that standpoint because there's no character, there's no Japanese character in that entire movie that you're like, oh, wow, they're kind of normal. They're either like over-the-top eccentric TV presenters or directors or these bumbling translators or, you know, the kind of like techno-influenced children who are like banging on computer games.
Or like the other side of the spectrum, like really, really stoic, highly spiritual, quiet, timid people. Like there's really not much in between in that case. And I think that that's the thing that kind of annoys me, what Mike said about... you know, the reason they get together, not only because of xenophobia, but I think part of it is because they're kind of misanthropic. Like, they really don't like other people other than themselves. Mm. And, that the way that they meet does kind of stick out as a little bit weird. The only reason that they even notice each other because they're both Caucasian. I mean, if Scarlett Johansson's character was played by, like, an Asian American... as opposed to, like, you know, she could still be the same character, she could still be American, but, you know, someone who's Asian American, then Bill Murray wouldn't have noticed her anyway. I think I stumped you a little bit with that, huh? Or is it, like, way too crazy and offensive that you don't even want to say anything?
I didn't hear what you said, sorry.
Oh, that's great.
Sorry, someone just texted me.
Okay.
I think you're right about that. I don't know. I think they would adjust, you know. Like, they could have had a story where it's like a second-generation American who's never been to Japan and doesn't speak Japanese, and maybe they just connect because they both order the same drink or something stupid like that. But just the fact that he's like, oh, there's somebody who won't, like, shake my hand and bow and stuff. It just seems weird.
I mean, it's a beautiful looking film, and I think Bill Murray is, he really is, I think, amazing in it. I mean, it's just like as flat and shallow the story is. I mean, I don't want to say shallow, but I would say flat. Like, there really isn't that much that happens in it, and I think Sofia Coppola's true saving grace is the existence of Bill Murray. If someone else was in this part, that wouldn't be able to carry it as much or wouldn't be able to bring as much, then it would really fall flat.
Yeah, it's very true.
Yeah, so it's just I think that the casting and the visuals have a lot with carrying it, but it doesn't necessarily, I don't think it necessarily turns it into like a great film that's worthy of, you know, all that accolade.
Cool. Yeah, I think if I think about it, like, if I look at individual scenes, I could be like, oh, I really enjoyed that scene. But then you add it up and, like, the part where the lady's, like, lip my stockings and all that, like, it's just, like, it's not, I'm not even that so offended by that. It's just, like, it's so silly.
Mm.
I don't know. It when you put it all together, it makes it into this, like, a kind of a mediocre film.
Mm. Yeah, and also Sofia Coppola thinks way too highly of herself because... I've seen her in interviews. She's nowhere near as hot as Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
So, guys, what do you think? Final thoughts? What's your thought on it, Kareem?
I give it 2 thumbs up.
Yeah? You still like it?
I think it's a great movie. I think it's a really, like, original, creative, fun music. The soundtrack's awesome. The storyline is kind of weird and meandering and really engaging for whatever reason. And I think the performances from both Scarlett Johansson, who I think is just really incredible. You know, and she's become this massive star since then. And I guess this was the film that put her on the map.
Mm.
And, you know, it is kind of like this whimsical, hipster, dreamlike, you know, narrative, but at the same time, you know, it's one of the better, it's like a good representation of that kind of aesthetic and that particular style of filmmaking. I really enjoy it. And then, as you said, Bill Murray is he's just masterful. He could just make, you know, painting a wall fascinating.
Yeah if there's any reason to watch this movie, that would be Bill Murray, I think. And I gotta give it to you about the music too. I thought the soundtrack was pretty sweet. What did you think, Mike? What's your final?
I guess you convinced me. Now I rub this movie.
Yeah, that was an interesting, like, interestingly racist scene as well, where when they, like, have this conversation about, like, why do they keep pronouncing L's with R's, you know? Mm-hmm. I was just like, that's just, like, there was something really racist about that. But
I think, like, it would be okay to do that, like, in a scene, but it's, like, every scene that has a Japanese person, mm-hmm. they do that. It just seems over the top.
Yeah.
Lip my tights.
Lip my tights.
Yeah. That scene was that was one of a couple of scenes that I felt were just too much.
Yeah.
You know, it's just on the floor and doing all that kind of crazy stuff. I guess there's the whole, you know, the whole idea that Japanese are into, like, some really kinky kind of sexual stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's like another kind of massive stereotype. And that scene was just like, what on earth was going on?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah, exactly. It was just weird. So, Mike, you basically changed your mind on it, and you love it now?
Yeah. I think it's okay. Like, I never hated it, but I feel like a lot of people think it's so great. But I'm like, it has these, like, big flaws that I can't look past.
Yeah, I have the same kind of feeling. It's not a bad or offensive film in any way. And I think it's just, like, a very pretty film that kind of shows, like, what would, like, kind of a travelogue look like if it was made by, like, these, like, very talented filmmakers. And yeah, I think it is just kind of meandering, and it is kind of it's not really slow paced. I just don't think there's really not that much to pace with within the story. But yeah, I guess it's okay. I'm kind of in between you guys in that case.
Won't be the first time.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's just a lot less painful this time, though. Mm-hmm. That's the difference.
So the next film we're going to be looking at is The Weatherman, starring Nicolas Cage and Michael Caine, which came out... When did it come out, guys?
2005.
And this is our underappreciated film.
Mm-hmm.
And introducing this film today is Ege. And Ege, you want to give it a go?
Yeah, I think... I picked this film because I think it's one of the most underrated films of the last decade. I think it has a great script, amazing performances, a great way to use voiceover, and it's an anomaly in the way that it's a big budget studio film, but it has this feeling of a very kind of low budget, independent character study, and I think in that way it succeeds in every way. I still love this film. What do you guys think?
I think it's a great film. I think it's actually, it's on that same kind of emotional tone as Lost in Translation. It's probably a little bit more Hollywood and a little bit more comedic maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But I love this story because the character, Nicolas Cage, he's such a hit and miss type of actor. Most of the time, you know, you see him in movies, it's just like, oh, God, what's he doing now? You know, he clearly needs money because he's doing some of the work. But when Nicolas Cage hits, and I say, like, you know, films like Adaptation and this, he's the best at what he does.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of this examination of this guy who's, you know, doing well in life, but at the same time, like, his kind of grip of reality, he's losing his grip of reality, and he's doing well by certain standards, but by his own father's standards, he's a kind of failure. He doesn't know how to relate to his wife or his ex-wife or his daughter, and it's just this fascinating kind of exploration of a man who's on the brink of losing his mind. And I really enjoy the movie. It's got some hilarious scenes, especially with the camel toe.
Yeah. that one quick cut of the camel toe is just brilliant.
Yeah.
When they talk about, like, his daughter having a camel toe, and he looks at the dress, and you just get this quick snap of an actual camel toe, and it doesn't get better than that.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you think, Mike?
Yeah, well, like I said, I chose Lost in Translation because of, like, the thematic similarity of, like, this successful person who's kind of adrift in their own life. But yeah, I think, like Kareem said, this is a much more, or for me, it's a much more interesting portrayal because you can see why he's dissatisfied. You know, like Bill Murray, it's like you have $2 million and you have to spend a week in a hotel. Oh, that kind of sucks, but whatever. But this guy, there's so many things going wrong and so many things going right at the same time. It's interesting to see how that can tear somebody apart.
And the whole weather analogy, I like that it's not too ham-fisted. Like, it's just, it's not hammered into your head. There's all this talk about, like, oh, you know, it's wind. It blows all over the place, and that comes up all the time, and the unpredictability of weather. And, of course, that's a symbolism for the unpredictability of the weatherman's life, that he can't control all the aspects of his life. If he gains more accolade through his career, then his family life kind of goes down the toilet. But, you know, it's like this perfect way of putting that symbolism full circle in the end. But I like that it's not just like totally hammered into your head. And also, I think it also has one of the best uses of a voiceover that I can think of. The usually voiceover, when it's utilized, it has to be kind of literal and a little bit stoic and a little bit, it has to be like really, really well written. And this, in the sense that you're not just listening to the character's thoughts, but it's kind of like the character has written all this prose later on, and it's just kind of like telling you the story through that prose. And the voiceover in this is kind of like the kind of dumb thoughts that go through this character's head. And my favorite scene in the whole movie is, I think, the thing with the tartar sauce. Mm. And it's just a brilliant way of showing how this kind of stream of consciousness inner monologue can work. And it's just the writing and the execution of that scene, I think, is brilliant.
I kind of like it when he loses it on the ex-wife's husband.
Oh, yeah.
And he just takes out the gloves and he's like, who are you? What are you doing in my house?
Yeah. That's one thing I really love about this movie, is that there's never a funny scene that doesn't have a little bit of pain in it. And there's never a painful scene that doesn't have like a little bit of humor. You know, you're always just kind of balancing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. They're all kind of mixed together. And sometimes you can't even tell if you're just laughing because of how uncomfortable it is, or if it's just the other way around, if you're kind of uncomfortable, but you feel like, oh, this should be a funny scene, like when Nicolas Cage's ex-wife tells him, you know, I never enjoyed sucking your dick, and then you see like the little girl standing there, their little daughter, and it's just like, it's so uncomfortable and weird, yet really funny at the same time. I think it's the same thing with like that camel toe thing, or the whole thing with. I mean, there's so many things in this that have this kind of inventive, ridiculous things in it, but it comes from a real painful place. Like the whole thing about him getting hit with like fast food items all the time, and like in an Adam Sandler movie, that would have been taken into like such ridiculous extents. But in this case, I think it's really inventive and kind of silly and ridiculous, but at the same time, it really fits the character. And in the end, that whole thing kind of comes full circle as well.
I think something we didn't touch on with Lost in Translation, or maybe we did a little bit, but is how much the city plays a role in the movie. And I feel like in this movie as well, like Chicago is almost as big of a character, you know? Like just seeing the cold, empty streets and everything, it really, I've got so much of a sense of that place.
I watched this film with a friend of mine, and I was really excited because I was like, oh, you got to watch this. This film's hilarious, you know? And I watched it with her, and she was like, she didn't laugh. I don't think she laughed once, or maybe she laughed a couple of times initially out of politeness. And I think we were about, like, you know, at the archery scene with the ice. And, you know, he's just out there. And I think he points.
Another funny thing. The arrow to his wife's boyfriend.
Yeah. Which is just like such a classic scene where you're just like, oh, he's about to lose it.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's just like, wow, this film's really bleak. And there's something I love about that. Like, maybe it's just it kind of plugs into my own sense of humor. But I just love that balance again between such a dark, miserable, despair-filled world, that somehow has got this character's walking through in it. It's got so much life to it at the same time. But I guess some people just don't find that funny.
Yeah, that's part of the thing why it's so unique and special to me is because it is a big budget studio film starring Nicolas Cage and Michael Caine and all these people, and yet it's really uncompromising in its bleakness. And it's a very dark comedy, and I guess it kind of depends on your point of view about whether or not you feel like it's just dark and bleak, or you find some humor in the pain of these characters. And that's true. I mean, there's a lot of people, and that's part of the reason why it didn't make a lot of money, because it was advertised as a straight comedy. And when people saw it, they were like, wow, this is kind of a bummer. Like, I work all week, and I go to the movies over the weekend, and I have to watch this guy, you know, just go through all this, like, pain and suffering that I have to go through. So it's just like, it's interesting in the way that it is a big studio film that, of course, is, you know, there's going to be less and less of these, because pretty much anytime someone takes a chance on a story like this on a big budget level, it usually just tanks, because people just don't want to see true examinations of human nature, I guess. So I wanted to talk a little bit about we talked about Nicolas Cage a little bit, and of course he's the butt of the joke now, because he lost all this money because of, I guess, tax problems or something like that, and so now he has to take any job he can and just making all these like shit action movies and stuff like that. But I think after a while we just kind of forget how good he can be in the right role. I mean, he's amazing, and like if you think about Leaving Las Vegas, an adaptation, and Lord of War, which came out the same year as The Weatherman, and that's a completely different character from what he played in this. And I think we kind of forget about that. And it's just, there are so many like little moments in this film that are just brilliant. Like the part where he just like, he finally gets hit with the apple pie and he loses his shit. And he starts running after the guy who's driving. Mm-hmm. And he just keeps saying like, I gotta see my kids. I have to see my kids, and apple pie on my coat. And he just like throws it in and just like loses it. And it's just so much fun. It's so like invigorating to watch.
Yeah, I feel like like we were saying about Lost in Translation, I feel like it would be a very different movie, granted, but Nicolas Cage could have played that part. And it, you know, like I said, it would be have a totally different sense of humor and stuff, but he's the kind of guy who he can walk that line of being like totally dramatic but funny at the same time.
Yeah. I wanted to mention Michael Caine as well. I think this is one of his best performances ever. And it's interesting to me that he didn't get a lot of a lot of awards or nominations and stuff for it. It just kind of went away. I mean, he got an Oscar for that. What was that movie? Cider House Rules shit?
Yeah, and he was terrible in that.
Yeah, he was just like so hammy in that. And this is like such a brilliant performance and such a wonderfully written character as this father who's just disappointed in his son, wants him to do better. And like the most classic things in the film for me is when he hears people cursing or talking about sucking and fucking, and he just turns around, he's like, what is all this sucking and fucking? What is this? You know, he just can't understand why people talk like this or why people act like that. And
I feel like 60% of his dialogue is just questions about what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, and it could have turned into this, like, you know, curmudgeon old man character who just can't understand this crazy world around him. It could have turned into this cliche. But there's something about him that's just, like, his performance is, like, really genuine and heartfelt. Like, he wants to understand. He wants to support his son. But he just can't. So there's this, like, genuine emotion behind his questions. And that's what makes it, I think, so beautiful.
Yeah, I love that scene when he's explaining to Nicolas Cage about the camel toe situation.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite scenes.
Yeah, and I think my favorite scene in that is the, I don't know if you guys would agree, because we all have a very special connection to Bob Seger. Mm-hmm. So it's the like a rock scene where his father hears that part of the his like living funeral speech or whatever, and they just talk in the car, and there's something about that scene where you see that it's just this father and son who never really connected up until that moment. And the thing they just connect about is basically, like, you just do your best and you can't really control your life. And it's just, like, puts across this very simple message in a very heartfelt and touching way without being, like, ridiculously hammy and melodramatic. I think it's just a wonderfully written and executed scene.
Yeah.
What do you think about that, Kareem?
I agree.
Yeah? Okay.
He's like he doesn't understand the like a rock analogy, and then eventually he does. And this is kind of the poignant moment before his father dies.
Hmm.
It's you know, there's a lot of sadness in this movie. Like, I can relate to this character, the main character. He just feels like he's never quite getting things right in life, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I just really like the kind of movies that are like, they're not really trying to make you laugh. They're not really trying to make you feel sad. They're not trying to be all like, oh, we're going to do a comedy, we're going to do a drama. They're just trying to put this character out there,
mm-hmm.
and show you these situations. You know, of course, there's humor in it, there's drama in it, but none of it is pulled in a certain direction to make it one or the other. So it just turns into this, like, really dark but kind of oddly emotional and heartfelt dramedy or something like that. So I think in that case it really works, and it's just
a lot of pain in the movie, mm-hmm. especially the relationship to the wife, you know, like, you know, he's still trying to get her back, and this new guy's in there, and you can see that the new guy's actually much better, and he's struggling with his relationship with his daughter, and his daughter is such this kind of character that you're like, if that was my daughter, I would be struggling with her too, you know, like,
yeah.
want to love her because she seems, you know, like a sweet girl, but you know that a girl like that's not going to be able to survive in the real world, and that whole camel toe reference.
Yeah.
And then later it becomes about his relationship with his father, you know, and his father's just on a kind of like a much higher plane of success, and almost like a worthy plane of success. Mm. And then he's on this kind of, he's doing everything right. He's got like a high paid salary and he's doing well, but it just, everything just, nothing quite fits right in his life.
Yeah.
And, I think Nicolas Cage plays that role to perfection.
Yeah, and the ending just fits, that just summarizes it up so well. He's kind of like, I just love that piece of dialogue when he's on the float and he's like, well, I'm behind the fireman, like the New York fireman. Maybe I don't get as much respect and accolade as they do, but I'm also in front of SpongeBob. You know, at least I'm not this like ridiculous cartoon character. I still have a little bit of dignity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting to me. But yeah, it's true. It's just like the pain in the character really comes from a real place, and that's what I really like about it. And also the people involved with it, the director is the guy who made like Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at it in terms of like the kind of movies that you wouldn't expect from a certain director, you know, when you look at the names behind a certain film and you're like, oh wow, that's gonna be, there's no way that can work, and I think it really does. In that case, it's just like really kind of surprising as well.
Yeah, I think, and also Rango, he made that as well, right? And like those two are, I think, two of the most interesting movies of the last 15 years, you know, for a director who makes two of the worst movies, arguably, of the last 15 years.
that guy doesn't really get a lot of subtlety in between. Like, you don't get a lot of middle ground. It's like, it's either great or it's just shit.
Yeah.
That's like all you get. You either get all these, like, Pirates of the Caribbean movies, or you get, like, you know, two of the best films of the last decade.
Did he direct the new Lone Ranger film?
Yeah, I think that looks like crap too, actually. So I don't know. I feel like the rule with that guy, his name is Gore Verbinski, is if Johnny Depp is in his film... Oh, wait, but Johnny Depp did the voice for Rango.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the rule is if Johnny Depp is physically in his film, then maybe you should just stay away.
Yeah.
That could be the bottom line. But yeah, so What are your guys' any final thoughts on this? What do you think, Kareem?
I would say that Lost in Translation is still, in my estimation, a great film. It's an interesting film in so much as it's probably not as it doesn't deserve as much attention as it got when it first came out. But I think it got as much attention as it did when it first came out because it was so interesting and unusual, and it was made by this kind of like, we were like, wait, this is the woman from Godfather 3.
Yeah. So
that was a shock by itself. But I think that if you're looking at The Weatherman, it's one of those films that you might, it's like, didn't he come out with a film called The Family Man as well?
Yeah, and that was terrible.
Right. So, you think, oh, Nicolas Cage has done all these films of The Weatherman, The Family Man,
The
like
Wicker Man.
The Wicker Man, that's true.
Matchstick Men.
Yeah.
It's like, don't write, because all those other ones are shite.
Yeah, that's true.
The Weatherman is one of those ones that, like, if you're in the video store and you're like, oh, well, it's just another Nicolas Cage film. No, it's actually a good one. And it's got a lot of depth to it and a lot of, it's a bleak film. So if you don't like bleak films, don't go for this one. But it's got a lot of heart to it as well. And if you're looking to find a film that you can relate to some of the pain and the difficulty with some amazing performances by the heavyweight actors, this is a good way to go.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I just think, like you said, that SpongeBob analogy is like the perfect analogy for the movie. I would say, like, you have a scene where he's watching like a SpongeBob float go by his hotel room window, and you have a scene where he's like beating a pedophile. Like, those are like, the kind of the juggling act that the Gore Verbinski is doing in this movie, and I think it's really fascinating to watch.
Yeah, it is kind of like a premise that could easily turn into like a train wreck, and it doesn't. It's like firmly held in place, and I couldn't agree more with what Kareem is saying, and that's part of the reason why I keep trying to champion this film, because it's not what you think it is. That's the whole point, is that as Nicolas Cage keeps making more and more of these like really terrible, shitty movies, and Wicker Man is like a colossal piece of shit, by the way. Do not watch that without like riff tracks or high copious amounts of weed in your system. But yeah, that's basically what it is. It's like it's one of the really good ones, and it's not like it's a film that's like that works despite Nicolas Cage. I mean, he's I think amazing in this film, and so is
everybody. Really,
pretty much everybody else in it is just really amazing, and it's just one of those films that's like everybody will pass on, I think, but really does need to be looked at again. It deserves a second chance, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.